It's an 87th Precinct podcast. This is the only podcast in the world dedicated to Ed McBain's 87th Precinct mysteries, the genre-defining series of police procedural novels, which began in 1956 with Cop Hater and ended in 2005 with the novel Fiddlers. There were 55 books in the series, and today's podcast is all about book number 20, which is Doll. To review the book, I'm joined by two notorious jailbirds from Sing Sing, Mr. Morgan the Gouger Brown.
Hello.
And Mr. Stephen the Tunneler Royston.
Hello.
Oh, you sounded that notorious there, didn't we? Oh, well.
Well, that's perhaps the key to your success.
That's it, yeah.
And anyway, here's the usual reminder. You can find us on all social media, podcast apps, YouTube, Instagram, etc. as Hark87 Podcast. And if you'd like to drop us $3 for a digital coffee, as so many of you are doing, I mean, we can't help but move for emails confirming the amount of contributions.
You two just had coffees. I never had one.
They were real coffees. We've got a coffee site, ko-fi.com/Hark87Podcast, and you can donate towards running the show if you like to. We're going to carry on anyway until they drag us away.
Which they inevitably will.
Yeah. So it's been a little while since the last podcast, or the last book podcast anyway, but in the interim, I interviewed James Naughtie.
Oh, yes, you
from
did.
The BBC.
Mm,
and put that out as well. So
very prestigious.
That was a high-profile guest.
Mm.
I hope everyone enjoyed that. He very much enjoys Ed McBain, very passionate reader of mysteries. And so, yeah, that was a very nice treat. Hopefully we'll be able to talk to him again at some point in the future, do a slightly longer podcast. Right, let's get on to Doll, because this is the second of the 87th Precinct books that come out in 1965.
Okay.
The last one being He Who Hesitates, the one we did before. Although the copyright date for this book is the 11th of October, 65. I think it came out around December. But when we have two in a year, I normally turn over our little chat about what was going on in the charts over to Christmas. Mm. And actually, we're nearly at the Christmas season. The lights are up in a lot of places.
Yeah.
They did the switch on at my work yesterday. Turned some trees on. Yeah, so it doesn't hurt to start getting a bit Christmassy.
So Crimbo 65.
Crimbo 65. Well, I'm not going to go mad on this because I think there's a lot to talk about with this book.
Mm.
But we'll have a look at the charts. And so if you can, as always, if you can think what might have been dominating the charts here in America in 1965, Christmas Day.
Matt Munro.
No, Matt Munro. He said, having to look really close.
Somebody like him.
Well, it's 1965.
So,
you know,
the Beatles?
The Beatles are number one in the UK.
I prefer Matt Munro's, I guess. What were the number one with at Christmas?
Double A side, 1965.
What, Penny Lane?
No.
No, that's a couple of years earlier there, aren't we? It would be...
Ah, the cogs are turning.
Very, very slowly. I can't even think, isn't that terrible?
So, let me have a guess then.
Go on then.
I always think Penny Lane's earlier than it is. I always put that in about...
Day Tripper?
It's Day Tripper.
Yeah.
Backed with We Can Work It Out. Not backed with it, but double A side. Mm. So both they were number one. In the UK anyway. We weren't in America. Although America's still Brit invasion crazy at this point.
Dave Clark 5.
Dave Clark 5.
Come on, shooter!
A song called One. Over and Over.
Over and over and over again.
I'd bang the desk if I was allowed.
No, don't do that.
But yeah.
I suspect that was a very accurate rendition, particularly of the drum playing of Dave.
I made up one of my guesses came true.
Yep. We definitely captured the stomping.
I'm not 2 years too early for them, am I?
Oh, well.
Spot on.
Yeah, but when it gets to the time when you can guess Penny Lane, you're going to choose something else, aren't you?
Well, I am, yeah.
Anyway, there's a few little interesting ones, actually, between the two charts. For instance, in America, I only printed out the top five for the UK, but I printed out the top eight for the American charts, just because at number eight is England Swings by Roger Miller.
Like a pendulum do.
England Swings like a pendulum do, Bobby's on bicycles, two by two, Westminster Abbey, the Tower of Big Ben, the happy little face, oh, the happy smiling faces of the little children.
How on earth do you know the lyrics to that song?
England swings like a pendulum do.
I only knew that line. But I obviously should have been paying more attention
because
to the rest of it.
He's the good Durham Town guy, isn't he?
And we're leaving's going to get him down.
Was he not a whistling man, Roger Miller? Yeah, no, that's Roger Whittaker, isn't
it? Yeah, I do tend to get the...
Roger... So was Durham Town
Roger Miller's King of the Road?
Oh,
yeah,
right.
That sounds about
I'm
right.
Thinking of Roger Whittaker.
Yeah.
Just thinking,
we're always
how
thinking
on
of
earth
Roger
was
Whittaker
he at number 8 in the American charts? Who did Durham Town?
I don't know. Listeners, well, if you know who did Durham Town...
It was a stupid song about Durham Town, and he had a beard, this fella.
It might have been Roger. I think it might have been Whittaker, yeah.
Roger. I think it...
One of the notable Rogers.
Notable Rogers of the past.
See, to me, Roger Miller played for Cameroon in the 1990 World Cup.
It was a man of many talents.
And all the while he was singing, England swings like a pendulum do.
I think there's also a Roger Miller in
Mission
of Burma too.
Yeah. Mission of Burma.
So, you know, wide and diverse range of music.
I would love to hear a Mission of Burma cover of England swings.
Yeah, it was Roger Whittaker.
Okay.
So that's why I was so surprised that he was at number 8
well,
with the song about swinging England or whatever it's called.
We've barely started the podcast and there's been a surprise Roger.
The least swinging man
ever. True. But there, the American chart, number 2 is Turn, Turn, Turn by the Byrds.
Nice.
Folk rock kicking in there. But number 3 is I Got You, I Feel Good by James Brown.
Excellent.
Which is pretty heavy.
Mm-hmm. Some good chowns.
Yeah.
Dave Clark all over them all.
Yeah, obviously pipping James Brown at the post as would always be the case.
The more authentic performer.
Yeah.
Well, James Brown was never a stuntman like Dave Clark was, you see.
He thought he was the hardest working man in show business, but he'd not met Dave Clark.
No, he hadn't.
Wasn't as loud on the drums anyway,
certainly
was he? Or as relentless.
So in the top 5 of the UK, there's 2 entries in the top 5 for Ken Dodd.
Excellent.
Of course, yeah.
Happiness?
Is not one of them. In fact, almost the opposite, Morgan.
Tears?
Tears is the other.
It's the only other one I know.
And there's one called The River.
The River?
I don't know if it's Mersey themed, but it's... Ken Dodd, for folks who don't know, was a Liverpoolian comedian. And he was very, very popular, particularly when sort of Beatlemania and the Merseysound craze kicked off and everything sort of northwest and Liverpool was very, very popular. And he died this year, didn't he?
Within the last year, definitely.
He was famous for doing stand-up shows, comedy shows that would last for hours and hours and hours. Literally, the sort of lock the door, don't let them leave. What else we got? Oh, The Carnival Is Over by The Seekers.
Oh.
And a Cliff Richard song I've never heard of called Wind Me Up, Let Me Go.
Wow, sounds feisty.
Crikey. He's got a new album.
Yeah,
out.
I saw the advert for his new album. It seems very defiant.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
there we go. Yeah. He was singing it on Radio 2 the other day and it sounded absolutely dreadful.
I can imagine. Oh, just speaking of Cliff and totally off topic otherwise, I just saw Espresso Bongo for the first time.
Oh, excellent stuff.
Recently. Yeah, a bit grittier and racier than I expected, to be honest, with Cliff in it.
Well, yeah, you know.
It's quite saucy in parts.
Then were the dark days of early British rock and roll.
Oof.
So instead of movies and things, we've done all the movies in the last podcast for 65. Christmas Day television in the UK. And I'm not going to make you guess, but you could probably guess one thing that was on television for definite on Christmas Day.
The Queen.
The Queen's speech, yeah, at 3 o'clock, like it always is and still is. That'd be weird when it's someone else doing that.
Mm.
Doctor Who was on as a Christmas thing, which it isn't this year for the first time in ages. There was the very famous episode in 1965 of Doctor Who where William Hartnell breaks the fourth wall and wishes everyone at home a Merry Christmas as well.
Ooh.
In an episode called The Feast of Stephen. What else have we got? Oh, and this is nice. Max Bygraves meets the Black and White Minstrels.
Oh, wow.
That sounds uncomfortable.
It certainly does.
I bet you
got a fly on the wall documentary or an entertainment programme.
Who knows? There's a thing on before Doctor Who called about Val Doonican. Val Doonican appeals for family service units. I don't know what that is. That sounds very intriguing.
imagine you were a TV commissioner in those days.
Golden age of entertainment.
Yeah.
When you could put Max Bygraves meeting the Black and White Minstrels on and know you'd get 11 million viewers.
Yeah, Max Bygraves goes caving, I don't know. Dennis Norden climbs Mount Snowden.
Would watch.
It'd be great, wouldn't it?
With his clipboard.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, Tommy Cooper walks the M1 live. Imagine that.
Talking about Ken Doddy, he had his own show. He had an hour-long show on at 9:30 that
night.
Only
an hour? Wow.
Yeah, and Top of the Pops was on in that evening at 10:35. Gosh. Presenters including Pete Murray, mm-hmm. Alan Freeman, David Jacobs, Jimmy Savile.
Yeah.
65 was the first year, certainly in America and then very much around the world, that a Charlie Brown Christmas was shown. Warmly remembered in the hearts of many listeners in America, I should imagine. It's lovely, the Charlie Brown Christmas cartoon.
Indeed.
Do you want an infrastructure fact, Steve-O?
The infrastructure fact from 1965 will be the opening of... What?
No.
No. No. Oh, God damn it. I was gonna...
It's not so much physical infrastructure in this instance.
Mental infrastructure.
Metaphysical infrastructure.
Not physical infrastructure.
Well, it is physical, but not like a road. Not like a road building scheme is what I mean.
Okay.
It was basically something that happened to motorways in the latter part of 1965.
Central reservation barriers.
No. It might have been that, but
motorway service stations.
No. No. I would say that they were physical infrastructure.
Well, so would I. I'm intrigued as to what this is.
Basically, it was when they imposed the 70-mile-an-hour speed limit on motorways.
Ah, right.
And all these motoring journalists were up in arms because they couldn't do 120 miles an hour down a motorway.
Because I think prior to that, there'd hardly been any traffic on them, so people were just razzing around on them.
Yeah.
And then party poopers put a speed limit on.
Well, it was introduced by the transport minister for the time, who was called Hugh Fraser, who this journalist described as a dour Scotsman with little experience or knowledge of cars and modern driving conditions. The idea that modern driving conditions would be allowing you people to go 120 miles an hour down a motorway.
He's there in his horse and cart going, slow down!
Well, you know, slow down!
Well, before in the early days of the motorway, they never had a barrier in the transport reservation, so people used to drive up one side and just do U-turns and come back the other, because they were a bit of recreational kind of use, because they were so strange. There you go. Oh, I thought it was going to be the opening of some bridge or something. I'll try and find one for you next time.
I'll do my level best.
We're in
expansion of the road system, really, in the UK.
There'd be bridges popping up everywhere.
This is what people tune in for.
Absolutely.
Think of a couple.
Come for the Ed McBain, stay for the British motorway history.
I can think of a few imminent.
Oh, right. Well, maybe I'll task you to find some out. Let's get to the book then. Sorry,
the
everyone.
It's a book now.
It doesn't feature any of the things we talked about.
This was a major infrastructure project of a literary nature.
Literary infrastructure.
Mm.
1965 then, second book, 20th in the series. And I reckon that this is a significant departure. Not a departure, a significant step in the development of the books.
I wouldn't disagree there.
Would you disagree, Morgan?
I wouldn't.
No, don't make me come over there. I found a little bit of background information. There's not masses of stuff you can find out about the writing process, because he tended, certainly for these earlier books, you tend not to get author interviews with him speaking about the actual writing process of a specific book or the background to it. Certainly from the mid-80s onwards, there's lots of high-profile stuff. It's quite easy to find him talking about things like money, 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 and things like that. He did tons of interviews. But in the archive, in the Ed McBain archive that's held up in Boston, I did find that the archive contains 17 pages of handwritten notes for this, two photos of the character Tinker Sachs, and that is the reproductions, presumably, that are in the book. Obviously, the typescript notes and rewrites of Doll, an original rough draft with some revisions, and then a bunch of letters. Now, this intrigued me. There was a bunch of letters in the box where Doll was stored. Not that I can read them, but I know what they are. Some that were written to Mrs. Ambler, some that were written to Mr. Ambler, the Mr. Ambler being Eric Ambler, the author, who wrote
a lot of important spy novels, of which I've never read a single one, but apparently really, really good and really, really significant. He was like one of Graham Greene's favourite writers, dead influential on the spy genre. And then that led me to think, well, I wonder if I can find out what their relationship was, because apparently some of these letters were to do with information about drug laws, which feature in this book. And this same place that holds the McBain archive also holds the Eric Ambler archive. And in the Eric Ambler archive, it says, the only entry for Doll says, second draft of screenplay based on the novel by Ed McBain. Mm-hmm. So Eric Ambler was apparently writing a screenplay based on this book, and no film emerged. So there is no film adaptation of Doll.
So he must have been. Was he quite old then? If he was like a favourite of Graham Greene,
I think he was. I'm not. Well, I'm not sure.
Must admit, I've never heard of him.
Yeah, I think the name rings a bell, but no one I know anything about.
We must find out more. Apparently, he's very, very good. But yeah, so he was having correspondence with McBain, and it looks like it was with a view to writing a screenplay. So yeah, Eric Ambler did write screenplays as well as books. Wow. So that's intriguing. We could have had a film of this, which would have been interesting. Instead, the only adaptation of this that we've got is from 1980, and it's a Czech TV production called Paninka.
Oh, that sounds interesting.
It's all on YouTube.
Oh. Is it?
Sadly not subtitled, but
you get the gist.
You get the gist of it.
I'm sure we can make up our own.
I think we will, after we've done this, perhaps we watch a little bit of it, just so you can see some of the clothes and hair.
Sounds good.
But yeah, if you want to watch that, everyone, it's on YouTube. It's called Panenka. I think from what I can tell is it's pretty true to the book.
Great.
Perhaps not as... Well, I don't, it's not that the book's graphic. Well, it is a bit graphic, this book. Maybe that's... Anyway, never mind. Do you want to do some reviews before we get stuck in? Contemporary reviews?
Why ever not?
I'll give... Well, you can do one each. Steve-O, do you want to be Anthony Boucher or do you want to be Morris Richardson?
Boucher is a bit of a sycophant, isn't he? I'll be the other guy.
Right, well, you can read and self-censor this one. Oof. On the left here. This is the guy from The Observer who writes for when it comes out in Britain.
Ooh, it's the text is a bit... Doll by Ed McBain. Hamish Hamilton. Small daughter of... Oh, well, we're giving the plot away a bit.
Scan it. While Steve-O scans the review from Morris Richardson...
Well, no, I'll just put blanks in. I'll do a bit of blankety blank.
I suspect this is going to be almost entirely blank.
Because I can't work... I'm not that quick-witted. Doll by Ed McBain. Small daughter of blank New York fashion model.
Not New York.
Hears through the wall her mother being stabbed.
That's fair enough.
Detectives Corella and Birkling investigate together, then quarrel. Corella carries on. The doll clues lead him to the source. He gets blank, 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 and...
and blank.
Blank full of blank by nightmarish, sadistic blank. Who's blank? But read it yourself, it's quite short. One of McBain's very best, and the horror isn't unduly played up.
So it's a good review, but the main content of the review is just listing what happens in the book.
It does, yeah. So that's why I heavily blanked it, because I'm not sure how many of those blanks we're prepared to give away in our own reviews. So
Morgan can take on the role of our old pal Anthony Boucher, which I think is less spoilery.
He'll be full of praise.
Yeah, he's generally pretty good with these things. So Steve Carella's impetuous brilliance in solving a hideously vicious murder leads to his own disappearance. That's not giving too much away, is it? Okay.
That's back of the book stuff.
And the efforts of Maya Meyer and the rest are devoted as much to finding Corella as to cracking the case. The writing is as effective as ever. Suspense runs high. And there's a pretty solution gimmick hidden in the title. Well, that slightly gives things away, but it's all right. Only a little bit. We kind of learned that that's quite an important clue. We don't know why necessarily, do we?
Yeah.
Well, it's repeated all the way through the book, so it's kind of hammering home.
Exactly.
But, you don't realise what it is until fairly late in the day.
I think generally when you get titles that are like one word and it's an object or something... or it refers to something like bread referring to money or whatever, you know that it's going to be the thing upon which everything hangs.
Yes.
And although he uses the concept of a doll in a couple of different ways in the book, it does feature a literal doll.
Yes.
What do you think? What were your impressions overall then of this one compared to, say, the 19 that have come before?
Well, I think you're spot on that it's a bit of a development. It certainly seems a bit grittier and a bit sleazier here and there.
Yeah.
And is there the first use of the F word in the series?
Possibly.
And yeah. There's a lot more kind of graphic nudity as well, and a bit more coarse language, I would say. Mm. And just all in all, a bit of a, yeah, a bit, well, you know, spells out kind of the gritty side of life in a lot of the other books, but this one's a bit more laid bare, I would say.
Yes.
At times.
Definitely, it does feel like, feels like the gloves are off a bit.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
I wonder whether it's that he felt that he was more able, sort of given the prevailing mood of how things were developing in, you know, film and TV and sort of, because you can't imagine this having been adapted for the the 1962 TV series, yeah. The 87th Precinct, which Absolutely. Was so sort of, well, clean cut.
If you think a lot of those, we always used to kind of mention that they could have made those with very little adaptation to the plot, whereas this would,
you couldn't have put this onto prime time, yeah, sort of TV,
yeah, just the subject matter really. So yeah, there's a bit of a shift really.
It takes a step up in sort of the visceral quality of what happens in it. It is violent in very specific and quite nasty ways, right from the off as well. And the procedural thing all hangs around a very emotional state for the cops to be in as well.
Absolutely.
So if we sort of begin at the beginning a little bit, I think like the first chapter, right off the bat, is the murder that happens. You know, this is our before we meet Columbo scene type thing, pre-credits scene, as I like to call them. And it's straight away, it's right in with a proper vicious stabbing.
Slashing and all sorts.
And it's all told, made even worse, even scarier by the fact that we're more or less told it from the perspective of a small girl who's listening to this in the next room. And it's her mother being killed. So this is the model, Tinker Sachs, who's the victim. In this, we learn very early on. And I know we've seen a lot of deaths early in the books, but there's few that are quite so terrifying and feel so brutal.
Mm, it certainly does.
Yeah, certainly up to this point in the series, it's yeah, particularly hard-hitting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Compared to what's gone before.
Then in chapter 2, I think, you're back to a fairly classic, unusual McBain character number one in the book. The main one, good old Cyclops.
Yes, this is great. This is one of the things with McBain and his characterisation. He could have just had anyone be the elevator operator in the building where the murder happens. Instead, it's a 6 foot tall, or over that, totally bald man with only one eye, who's nicknamed Cyclops.
Yeah.
And yet he draws him, and he's just seems totally real.
Yeah.
And this is the skill, I think, of McBain with these characters. Is that could be a real sort of, I mean, on TV, that if somebody introduced that character and it was cast to be like that, you'd go, whoa.
You'd just be watching this going, what on earth has the elevator operator only got one eye for? It's totally preposterous. But I don't know whether that's to kind of serve, because there's a lot about Kling in this being a bit of a pain in the ass. And so whether it kind of plays into his perception that Cyclops is a rubbish witness, or he kind of thinks he is, doesn't he, just because he's just got one eye. But yeah, a good character.
Well, we speak on Kling at the moment, because we've had a few books since Kling's girlfriend was murdered. He's been a pain in the arse to everyone around him. He's been difficult to work with. And this book opens with Lieutenant Burns threatening to kick him off the squad.
Mm.
As it turns out, it's not long before something Kling does or doesn't do, or his relationship with other people causes real trouble. But he has a bit of a character shift in this as well. I don't want to say redemption. Things come to a head.
Yeah, it's not quite the sort of road to Damascus moment, but it feels like a turning point for him, doesn't it?
One of the funny things that comes out of their questioning of Cyclops, the elevator operator, is that he describes the man who came out of Tinker Sax's room as looking like the actor Sonny Tufts.
Oh, yeah.
His name Sonny Tufts keeps cropping up.
I had a look at him earlier, yeah.
A bit of a quiff.
Yeah, blonde quiff.
Yeah, blonde quiff.
Did you find anything else out about
him? Not much. He was an alcoholic who died at 58.
Yeah.
But I think he's one of the main Paramount actors of the 40s who's starred in tons of films you've never heard of, but would undoubtedly have been a fairly
He was a common, leading man for a while.
Yeah, and then I think his career hit the rocks somewhat in due to his lifestyle, and he got plenty of lawsuits for biting women, I seem to remember. But he had a bit of a fairly, imagine Tintin crossed with like a quarterback, a fairly muscly guy with a quiff and a big barrel chest.
Proper all-American.
So you can imagine what he was like. So yeah, I'd never heard of him actually, but
well, it's there's a great bit when the guy describes him as saying his hair's like Sonny Tufts' hair. I first have thought, well, Sonny Tufts sounds like a made-up name. Also, the fact that Corella goes Sonny Tufts, like, what a reference point. Because by 1965, this guy had already become legendarily sort of...
Yeah, I think he was on...
Useless.
Yeah.
He was doing big parts in TV by that point.
I think he was a spent force, really.
I think he starred in My Mother, the Car.
All right.
Which I think we mentioned in one of them.
Brilliant.
It turns out that the only lead they've really got to follow is what the elevator operator has told them. And that she was a model, so they go to the modelling agency. And the modelling agency is one of those settings that McBain uses, which is out of the cop's comfort zone. Mm. It's so its own world. You do feel like if he'd have wanted to, he could have written a book about that modelling agency, because he sort of is so good at capturing those little snippets of environments. Corella and Kling are there, and they're trying to get through these really highly decorated rooms where you can't tell where the door and the wall ends, and they feel just really foolish because there's all these glamorous people there and all this.
You love stuff like photography studios and fashion studios. You know, there's always people crop up in plenty of the books who are industry. I suppose that was industries that he would be reasonably familiar with, I suppose.
I suspect, given that this is a sort of Manhattan world.
Hmm. Yeah, there'd be plenty of them kicking around from a kind of realistic point of view as well, yeah.
But he meets the couple who run that, and
he's got Sonny Tufts' hairdo as well, hasn't he?
He looks very Sonny Tufts.
Yeah, it's remarkable how many people are going around with Sonny Tufts.
In this book, there's quite a few of them, so.
Popular stylistic choice of the day.
19 books, no Sonny Tufts. Doll, Sonny Tufts all over the place. Then another 35 without any.
So you're at a loss as to which Sonny Tuft we're looking for here.
Yeah. Is it the man at the agency? Is it not? But basically, Kling's in such a shitty mood all the time that his questioning technique is so bad that Corella basically says, bugger off back to the squad room and leave me alone to do this stuff. So then that's a big no-no. You don't leave your partner behind.
He gets some photos, though, didn't he? You mentioned them earlier.
Yeah.
When before he leaves the studio, he gets some, I don't know what you would call them.
Well, it's like the promotional stuff.
Yeah, promotional-like photos.
Tinker Sax.
A bit of a portfolio, so isn't it?
Which are reproduced in the book, and I must have to say they're highly unusual, because one's fairly impressive as a close-up of the eyes.
Yeah.
And then the second one is fairly terrifying in that the way that the contrast has worked, the face looks like it's drawn on.
Oh yeah, it does.
And then the third one doesn't have a face.
Blanked out face, yeah.
And then the fourth one looks even more drawn on. So it's like,
it looks like the most extreme Instagram filter you could possibly have.
Yeah, it's like that flipping cartoon version of Lord of the Rings they made at the end of the 70s where it was like live action.
Rotoscoping.
Like an actual photo that in order to obliterate the actual face, they've kind of obliterated it and drawn on. Because that's definitely drawn on, isn't it?
It does look it, very much so.
So they're fairly creepy, to be fair, apart from the first one.
But they, yeah.
But anyway, that's just...
In terms of reproductions and insets in the book...
Quite interesting.
We don't usually get like four pages of photos.
No.
Indeed.
So that was a little treat there.
But that's the first of numerous in this book that I suppose we will
Reproductions of letters and poetry and
airline schedules.
There's also he was going hell for leather with the insets on this one.
Yeah, so which is always good.
Yeah, that's definitely that's definitely a tick in my 87 precinct bingo boxes. Yeah. Reproductions of forms or letters or photographs or things like that.
Yeah, I wonder if there was a conscious effort to get back to things like that after the sort of slight detour of He Who Hesitates.
Well, on that matter, our friend Stella gave us her thoughts on this one and saying that she thought that this book was always a memorable and favourite of the 87th for her, but it's even better when you read it after He Who Hesitates because there's so little procedural stuff in He Who Hesitates that it comes back in. It feels like it's really sort of dramatically back in force in this one. Mm. And it certainly is because you do get stuff from the Emmy and from the lab and all that sort of stuff as well. So one of the heroes, the unsung heroes of this book is Paul Blaney, the medical examiner, who doggedly does his job properly and therefore helps to move the investigation on. Because the investigation, such as it is, could have been over in Chapter 3. Because Corella, having kicked Kling back to the squad room, finds something out, we're not sure what it is, picks up a doll from the crime scene, rushes off to do something, and he ostensibly has solved the crime.
Yeah. Well, if he hadn't sent Kling home and he added his partner, yeah, it would have been a 3-chapter book, this, and over and done with.
Definitely.
But things go a bit pear-shaped.
That's an understatement, really.
some shit goes down, basically.
Yes, I think we're all right doing loads of swearing on this one because it's quite gritty as
well. After that, basically, you've got two things running in parallel, haven't you? I suppose you've got what's happening to
Corella,
and then the investigation.
The investigation that's fumbling along without the really vital evidence that Corella's got.
Yeah.
And the massive stumbling block of Tinker Sax's ex-husband, who obviously comes back to get his child. He's an archaeologist or something.
Yeah.
He's out looking for evidence of a tribe that used to be in Arizona. And he comes back and he's really obstructive and he refuses to say why he split up from his wife and why she was getting doctor's treatment when they finally find out she's getting treated by a doctor.
Well, he's a bit too good to be true, isn't he? Because he's very nice and he was still in love with his ex-wife, even though they were divorced. But he's similar-ish to Cyclops's description, isn't he?
Sunny Tuft.
He's got a hint of the Sunny Tuft about him.
Yeah, and he just seems a bit too good to be true. And then all these aeroplanes he was catching at times, it all starts sounding a bit suspicious, doesn't it, really?
It does, rather. I also was a bit confused by his kind of obstruction of the case because he must know that an autopsy is going to happen, and he must know that when the autopsy happens, the thing that he's trying to hide is going to come out anyway.
Yes, exactly. And even when ultimately they track him down in context of this doctor that's involved in the case, the doctor is very, very helpful. He knows that if the police are asking him questions, he has to answer honestly. And Tinker Sax's husband, Dennis, is still sat there going, no, I'll get you struck off. No, why? It's like, just calm down, man. They can't say that to him. Can't say calm down, man. No.
Well, they probably could have done.
But the worst thing is, after Chapter 3, a car turns up, burned out, with a body inside, and a police gun in it, and Steve Carella's ID. Now, I don't think it's a spoiler to say Corella obviously survives, because we've talked about him being in all of the books.
Yeah, I think we've already spoiled that one.
Yeah.
Might be one of those things that, is it the same Steve Corella? That might be,
Might be like when they changed characters in the TV sitcom Bread.
Yeah, maybe a bit like that, yeah. Although, having never seen Bread, I don't know what you're all about. Never heard of that programme. But no, yeah, of course. I don't think it's seriously, even when you're reading this without any reference of any other books, it never comes across, I don't know, a bit easy to say if you know he doesn't die, but he doesn't come across as though you really believe he's dead, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, you just have to live the reactions of, Teddy Corella and Kling and Meyer.
Yeah, you just think, well, you know he's not dead, but at that point, but what on earth's going on and who is dead and why isn't he dead? Because he's been initially held hostage, isn't he, by the perp. And then you don't understand why they would quite reasonably have bumped him off. And therefore,
what is very interesting is the montage sequence, basically, which talks about the reactions of the various detectives on the squad.
Oh, yeah, it's good.
Reacting to the different one, which is in Chapter 5. So, obviously, the chief of the detectives, Lieutenant Burns, has to tell Teddy Corella that her husband is probably dead. I mean, at this point, Teddy must be, like, the most stressed wife of all time, because Corella is repeatedly shot and left for dead. He's, of all of the cops, he's the one who's, apart from the events where Virginia Dodge was in the squad room shooting Miss Golo and people like that, Steve Corella really gets into some scrapes.
He really does.
For such a good cop, he does get hospitalised quite a lot. And now this. But then we have this montage of all the various cops dealing with it, how they deal with it.
My personal best reaction, of course, is Andy Parker, who goes out and gets very drunk and finds a prostitute and is quite horrible to her. But then he's been like kind of fairly, I don't know, he was a good man.
Yeah.
I always
hires
enjoy
a prostitute to not sleep with, just to have someone to talk to. It's a tragic side to Andy Parker, really.
Well, he's a bit of a tragic character, isn't he? But I always enjoy reading the bits with him because he's...
It opens with him saying that, you know, Parker hated Corella, but, you know, there's some sort of bond there of him. You know, he knows that Corella's a good man and he's a good cop. And it's, if it can happen to Corella...
Yeah. But, he's not the most in touch with his feelings.
No, he's not.
And one suspects he doesn't have a good support structure around him to help with these things. But it's like Cotton Hawes goes to a movie and just sits blankly through it and all that sort
May
of stuff.
May goes to the park, I think, does he?
Yeah.
But Kling, Kling's obviously the one who's...
Kling's fully in trouble because he... left his partner to go off, having had the row with him. And Lieutenant Burns is like, I can't suspend you, but I am going to get you suspended. Hmm. Oh, it's dramatic.
It was a bit harsh, that, really, because his senior officer tells him to go home, so it's not really...
Well, they do have Kling's words. Fault. They do have words, and Kling stomps off at some point, so that does happen. But we should... probably talk about what's happening to Corella at this point without trying to give too much away. Well, it's very hard to...
It is.
He's not dead. We're going to have to just deal with this. But he is...
Chained to a radiator.
He's chained to a radiator and he's being tortured.
Yes.
By someone whose name we never learn.
No, that's true, actually.
Oh, yeah.
We learn the name of the male perpetrator. Uh-huh. We never learn the name of the female perpetrator who's holding Steve Corella hostage.
Which is curious, because we get to find out the name of the male person, but don't meet them until the very, very, very end.
Yeah.
And yet we meet his female...
Accomplice
much earlier, but never get to know her name, which is quite odd, really. But she's a fairly unique kind of character.
Well, I think she's the most horrifying of his characters that he's introduced into any story so far. Even the deaf man has a different sort of agenda that's not personal. I know it becomes personal in later books. Yeah. It's more targeted. But she's got her personal thing of really, really hurting, breaking down, terrifying, destroying someone. Not even necessarily to kill him at this point, literally wants to rip his soul out. And she's weird.
Incredibly
sadistic, really just, very, very strange.
It's a sort of razor's edge of torture and sex as well in there as well. She's this something going on, and it's Corella, and you're willing him with all your might to survive it. you know, or to survive it well, to be strong throughout it. But he has a very, very hard time.
He certainly does.
But it takes them ages to find him. They've got to really, really piece this together. It does rely on evidence. Ultimately, it's them getting enough information to connect the dots of the few little bits of evidence that they've got.
Well, it starts with the will, doesn't it? Because she'd...
Yeah, so she's earning an absolute fortune. She's earning more than the president of America, it says at some
point.
And
yet she just prepared a will only, you know, a couple of months or so before her death, which is suspicious in itself. And she's got hardly any estate other than a Chagall.
Which I think probably gets covered in blood quite early on.
In scene one.
And so, yeah, the police get... They're quite suspicious about that, aren't they? And then that kind of does another... A bit of another classic, which I noted in this, which I think is something he's done in quite a few books now, the big secret of the victim, you know, that something that you don't find about them until very late on in the book, and it's a big revelation that the victim wasn't all that they seemed, and as soon as you understand what they were hiding, or, well, not that they were hiding, but the police hadn't sussed out... kind of leads them to that, then it's not too much of a jump to work out what perhaps might have gone on.
Absolutely.
And that's a combination of the will business and then the following Dennis Sachs to the doctor and, like you mentioned, getting him to spill the beans, that whether we're going to spill the beans or not, perhaps we'll leave that to a blankety blank.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Just be able to say the word blank for the rest of the show.
And
it's graft anyway. It is police graft for them, and they're doing it through this emotional haze of knowing it's their colleague or thinking it's their colleague that's being killed.
Because they're under no doubt. They carry on investigating Tinker Sachs murder because they're under no doubt that is what has led to
it's related in some way.
Carella's death.
I like the sequence where. Maya has to ring up someone in the LAPD to find out something about a previous crime that relates to Tinker Sachs's life. And it's something from like way back when, 13, 15 years ago. And so he names the character from the LAPD that he's talking to on the phone, which makes me think, is there a parallel world, a parallel 87th precinct in LA, you know, a series of books unwritten with these people happening over there? I like to imagine that there's an equivalent of this stuff going on in much more Hollywood sense.
Oh, of course, yeah.
But maybe that's Hollywood Station and all that lot.
Oh, it could be, yeah.
His face?
Joseph Wambo, yeah.
Yeah, we've never talked about Joseph Wambo on this, have we, really?
No, should do.
He's very much on the subject of books that are dark and horrible police stories, including procedural stuff. Joseph Wambo's LA stuff is... in that mould, isn't it?
Yeah.
That this feels like it's drifting in. Doll feels like it's getting towards that type of writing.
Yeah.
Wambo generally, a lot of his are about like patrolmen, isn't it? And more cops on the beat.
Not necessarily even always about sort of specifically focusing on the crime, but about the kind of characters of the policeman. So you'll just get sort of kind of into the psychology of the actual cops rather than focusing on the events that they're dealing with quite so much.
Yeah.
Things like the Blue Knight that just sort of follows this aging patrolman through his kind of daily routine. It's kind of heartbreaking and harrowing all at once. It's, amazing. Well worth a look.
If any of you, our listeners, who obviously love McBain, haven't read the Joseph Wambo stories, every single one I've read has been brilliant.
Yep.
The Quiet Boys
is an absolute beast.
You do have to brace yourself, though. They're not quite, they're not quite procedural. They are more dark.
A bit like McBain, he's quite good at the ridiculous character as well. Because isn't somebody called like Commander Moss in those? Mm. Who's like a total lunatic, like totally incompetent commander that they all don't respect.
Yeah,
but. They're quite sad, those books, as well.
They can be quite heartbreaking, but there is humour there as well. Yeah. I think a lot of it is drawn from real life. I know he was an ex-LAPD patrolman and then also kept contact with the force and used sort of stories from interviews with real cops as the basis of a lot of these things as well. But the Choir Boys and the New Centurions is
New Centurions, yeah.
And the
Blue Knight.
Yeah, excellent.
And then his Hollywood Station books.
Hollywood
that,
Crows, yeah.
That has that Nate, Nate, whatever he's called in. He's got a... they're all much more recent, aren't they? 90s yes, and noughties, yeah. But they're good as well.
Yeah,
well, get them on your Christmas list. That's what I say.
Yeah.
Well, but back to Doll, because we need to start wrapping up in a second with
Gosh.
This. There's a really good bit. There's not masses of comedy in this by any means. It's the comedy is sort of down a little bit on this one. Mm. Oh, yeah. Steve was
doing no, it. I bet you're just about to mention them though.
Well, the bit that I want to mention is where Maya Myers reading the report on the body that's being found, and this notion, it mentions that the body was completely bald, and that's because Maya is completely bald. He goes into this reverie about why do you always say completely bald, and he's used a dictionary to look something up, and he decides to christen himself the Bald Eagle. And Sam Grossman from the lab rings up and says, it's Sam Grossman here, and Maya goes, it's the Bald Eagle here.
Maybe a point for bingo, 87 bingo as well, is that you've got Culhoun and Carpenter.
Homicide cops we've not met before.
With the same name, who were kind of from, I suppose, internal investigations to investigate Kling at the end after he's...
Done what he's done.
And,
they always come in matching pairs. And they always have the same line of banter, don't they?
So this undoubtedly scores fairly heavy. And you mentioned about all the parts of the procedural here. You've also got, talk about Wambow as well, the patrolman. A patrolman's quite important in helping them suss out what's happened to Corella.
A brief moment in the book, but very important to make something... trigger in someone's in Maya Myers' brain.
So it's got a lot of elements coming together, this, I would say.
I think the thing with the Carpenter and Calhoun as the homicide cops at the end, rather than it being Monaghan and Monroe or someone like that, is because we've already got a relationship with Monaghan and Monroe, so they know what's happened to the 87th Precinct before. Mm. So having two characters we've never met before means that McBain can tell a better story with Kling at the end. I think it's quite a clever little thing. He still gets to have a little bit of the humour of these matching pair homicide cops, but he also means that they're a bit remote from the story and from the precinct. So it's quite a clever little thing, I think. Yeah. It's almost like he knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
Can you imagine? Right, so we better get towards summing up and providing our scores, really.
Oh, my Lord. Have you got the Kenneth printout?
Okay, I've got Kenneth somewhere on here.
I've got him on standby.
Yeah, ignore the other bits, but there's Kenneth for you. So
Kenneth.
We review in the context of the previous ones, and Kenneth, our machine for calculating the scores, always provides us with detailed punched cards and ticker tape, Steve-O is now running through his fingers and reviewing.
Well, yeah, I'm just having a look at that, which I always like to see. Up and down, what were we last for with the He Who Hesitates? We were, looks like about 73, that I would say, Police Shields.
Yeah.
Well, top score of 89 for, that'd be King's Ransom, I would say.
Yeah.
And the Cop Hater still in second position, 86. Uh-huh. Who'd have thought?
Okay. Well, let's go round and see how many Police Shields we're going to award each. And I'm going to go to Morgan first this time.
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean... as you say, it does feel like a sort of the series moving on to the next stage somehow. It's kicked into a different gear. It's exciting, it's dark and gritty. It's got a lot of what you want from one of these novels in it. And I enjoyed it very much. It was my first time reading it.
Ah, well, there you go. See, that's a good reaction.
Revelation.
To have. A good reaction
right
to
the end.
So I'm going to go in strong with a solid 85 Police Shields for this one.
85. Steve-O.
Right, well, I would concur with a lot of that, yeah. I think, as I've mentioned, it ticks a lot of boxes on the old with the old dabber pen in the
87 bingo.
Bingo, which is something nice in itself. But interesting story, reading it for the second time, I couldn't remember at all how it panned out. And there's not only revelations about the victim, but even the way that Corella had sussed it out very early doors, it was very clever and might be a bit gimmicky in the hands of somebody else. But yeah, I think it's an excellent entry and maybe the best to date. I don't know. I might be tempted for 90 Police Shields. I think it's a 9 out of 10 book, this. I think it's high echelon 87th Precinct.
I would agree with you as well. I'm concerned that Kenneth's hoppers for the Police Shields are going to get overflowing.
I'm sure he can cope.
We definitely...
It's very satisfying.
Yeah.
I think that's the word, yeah. And I suppose if you had to hand... You know, there's a handful of books here that if you thought, I've only got one shot to get somebody really hooked on this series...
This could be a good
one
to go in with.
The one you might hand them. I don't know.
Yeah, I think there's markers within the series of where things change or when new ideas come in, and this is definitely one of them. And I think as we move into the late 60s and into the 70s, we start to see the real, real classic 87th Precinct stories come to play. The ones that really suit the times that they're written in, the ones that really push forward in quite a bold way. We've got some coming up fairly soon as well that are absolute, you know...
Crackerjacks,
indeed. I was going to say archetypes, but I like Crackerjacks. It's very good. But this is on the way there, isn't it?
It is, I would say so.
And I'm going to split the difference a little bit here, and I'm going to go for 88, please.
Ooh, it's a corker.
We might be on for an 87 here. If you're rounding, yeah.
You know what happens with numbers here. Oh, what's happening with Kenneth? He's taking so long. It's an 87 Police Shield score.
That's perhaps...
87. Where does that put it?
Second, I think. Yeah, just...
Just behind just King's Ransom.
Pipped by King's Ransom, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the graph will shoot right back up
there. Which is perhaps fair, because King's Ransom's perhaps a bit more plot depth, maybe. Mm. Maybe. You know, and that's probably the most involved... Plot-wise, certainly from that era, but this, a bit of not a sea change, but a certain different tone to this, I would say.
Yeah.
So get out there and read it.
In my humble opinion.
Spoiled it too much, I hope.
I did a small amount of research about... this is the thing, but I don't think I can tell you what it was without spoiling a really vital part of the plot for everyone, so I might just not tell you.
We could do that in the bonus, because then if people don't want to...
Maybe we'll discuss it, and then we'll figure out if there's anything I can say about it in the bonus episode.
Okay, we could always bleep it.
Yeah.
Like we were telling something slanderous that we had to get rid of.
Yep.
Okay, well, we'll finish up there for the main episode. We'll be returning, hopefully be able to fit one in next month before the Christmas period.
Yeah,
so have a little,
we will, yeah.
Whether we do a full book thing or we do have a Christmas party, who knows? But we will be back, and the next book that we will be reading is 80 Million Eyes.
Mm.
Fantastic.
The one about the killer fly.
Yeah. So there's a teaser for you. So I'm going to say goodbye now, and I suspect my friends will do the same.
Goodbye.
Very well.
See ya.